podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Top Order Podcast. Boys are back from the Hagley Oval, where we've just witnessed a cracking test match at Hagley in Christchurch. Overcast skies pretty much all day at Hagley Oval. We will wrap up that New Zealand-Australia series. We're also going to cover the India-England series as well. Plenty of questions coming out. Is Stokes the right captain and is McCullum the right man to lead England forward as we move into the continuation of this Bazball era? We're also going to talk about Rohit Sharma's captaincy and permutations for India's next test match assignment, with some batting stocks rising, but some pretty big names to try and squeeze back into the India side, all coming up on the Top Order Podcast. Stay tuned. Well, boys, I've waited for the swish there, I think, Baldy. Was the theory.
Really nicely done.
I often talk over it, and Rigel has a bit of mirth on his face as I do that.
Always edit around that. It's no problem.
I do. Okay, it's good from you. Very good. But we're back from Hagley. I'm kind of sitting next to one pretty dejected soul and one quite happy soul, I guess. Let's start just with opening reflections on the test match. And we're literally less than 45 minutes after the conclusion of the second test. If ever, there's a sort of a nice place, a traditional place to watch cricket, it is the Hagley Oval. It's been a fantastic 4 days. But Lippy, might start with you. Your kind of thoughts coming, out of a day's play where it was pretty evenly poised as we arrived at the ground under leaden skies this morning.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's been a very emotional day. I feel quite exhausted, coming back now from Hagley. You said it was evenly poised at the start of the day. I think I have to admit that New Zealand were ahead at the start of the day. Four down already. Australia needed 200 to win. And we sort of talked about it before that, we kind of needed to take a wicket early. And we did that. We took Travis Head early, dropped Mitchell Marsh the ball before, and I think I said to you guys at the time, I would have quite happily reversed those. Marsh was someone who I was very worried about from a New Zealand point of view, just the way that I know Travis Head also scores quickly, but Marsh at one point had 45 off about 50 balls, and a friend of mine who was there with me said, it doesn't even really feel like he's, tried to score especially quickly, and he just kept that momentum going, and obviously the way him and Carey built throughout that innings was very, very impressive. So, yeah, look, I mean, obviously deflated. I think, we talked, me and Baldy, about how much this series means, I guess, from a New Zealand point of view. We desperately just want to beat Australia. We haven't done it for so, so long. And this was a prime opportunity to make it happen. And, look, for a number of little reasons along the way, we just haven't managed to get that final victory.
And Baldy, I'm just going to read some numbers out. 9, 11, 6, 5, 18. That isn't tonight's lotto number, but that is the top six performance from Australia in this second innings chase of 279. But, obviously no spoilers that Mitchell Marsh with 80 and Alex Carey, a fantastic 98 not out, iced the game for Australia. Your thoughts on this test tour assignment from an Australian perspective, and particularly a focus on this second test match performance at Hagley?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in terms of the papering over of the cracks that this test match victory will do for that top order. And I think we probably should deep dive a little bit into it, maybe not for too long, because there's other topics to talk about, and I could probably talk about it for an hour. But I think I always say that great cricket teams are ruthless, and what Australia have been missing over the last little period of time is an ability to be ruthless. And having got New Zealand all out for 160 on day one, Australia weren't ruthless in this test match. New Zealand fought their way back brilliantly because they played some terrific cricket. The other thing that great test teams do, though, is when they are behind, when they have their backs to the wall, and when there's a question about whether or not they believe that they can win, they show that they have that belief. And no matter who it is out in the middle, you get the feeling that they can do the job for you. And even though there were some heart-in-the-mouth moments, you always felt like when Carey was in and Marsh were in, Australia had the chase, not under control, but they were just chipping away just a little bit at a time. And that's what Australia did so brilliantly today, is that they just chipped away and chipped away and chipped away at the total until it became under control. And other than the Ben Sears moments, which we'll talk about, Australia really looked in control. Even with Pat Cummins out there today, he looked like at all stages of that chase that he knew exactly what he needed to do, and that he and Carey were able to shepherd Australia home.
I really think that, I mean, you talked about ruthlessness, but I think that what really shone through for Australia is patience. You know, the way that they, yeah, obviously, you know, you were frustrated at times in that first innings when, you know, they were bowling sort of looser balls or balls trying to buy wickets of the Tim Southee and Matt Henry's, you know, that tail for New Zealand, and it ended up maybe costing them 20 or 30 more runs in that first innings. Mm-hmm. You know, 162, you're still pretty happy to dismiss them for that. But I think what showed, especially in that second innings, is the way that New Zealand built partnerships, but Australia just never really panicked. They said, okay, well, that's fine. That's you know, you're allowed to have a partnership. Yep, it's okay. You guys are doing a nice job. The ball's died away. It's quite nice to actually bat out here now. But we're just going to run in and bowl good areas, and we've got good enough bowlers that we are eventually going to be able to extract something from this pitch, and that's what Pat Cummins did. That's what Josh Hazlewood did.
Absolutely.
And it meant that New Zealand never got far enough away in this game that Australia was ever out of it.
Yeah, yeah. There was only one moment, really, and that was that idiotic Marnus Labuschagne over that was a panic or we need to try something completely out of the box.
It was just before tea, wasn't it? It was one of those ones where a captain goes...
It was just after a session.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And all it really did was give...
Just before the new ball.
Yes, yeah. Two overs before the new ball. All it really did is give both batters a sighter after coming back out from a break to get themselves back in and seeing the ball. So that's really the only blemish in an otherwise very, very disciplined bowling performance. And but Australia had to bowl for stretches there when it was a very good batting surface. New Zealand were batting well, and I was kind of okay with that. New Zealand are allowed to bat well. They are allowed to build partnerships in the top six, and Australia had to really be patient and continue to bowl in good channels. And they did I think they did a better job than New Zealand of those patient overs of having to bowl dry and be very disciplined and not let New Zealand get away from them when they were building those partnerships.
Absolutely. I sort of want to frame, we were chatting with sort of quite a few Aussie fans during the series and particularly after day two, I think, and sort of a number of them, I was talking to them especially about how impressed I was with this Australian attack. That we've talked about it throughout the whole series. There's just no way out when you're a batter. A number of them made a comment which surprised me, and they said that this is the best Australian attack that they've ever seen. You know, so that's, you know, when I think of that, I sort of think, what, really? Because there were attacks with, you know, McGrath, Warne, Gillespie, Lee, those kind of attacks. You know, are this group reaching that kind of level?
I think there's less difference between one and four when you look at this quartet of Australian bowlers. There's no significant drop-off between Cummins, Stark, Hazlewood, Lyon. They're all very, very similar in terms of their record. Mm. And I think if you have a look at that one attack that you mentioned, McGrath, Warne, Gillespie, Lee, there's a little bit more variability. And that's probably only because McGrath and Warne are all-time greats. But, you know, if you have a look at Stark's record, Stark's now gone past Dennis Lilly in the series. Nathan Lyon's gone past 500 wickets in the last 6 months. You know, no other attack that Australia has produced has had all four guys take the field with more than 250 test wickets to their name. So it is now a conversation. I think any attack that has McGrath and Warne in it, it deserves to be, you know, at least up there in the conversation, if not outright the best attack ever. But this attack for Australia certainly has no weaknesses in it. And when you're going back to Cameron Green, who made stuff happen in this series, you go back to Mitchell Marsh, who's able to support Travis Head in the last 12 months, has done something with the ball and made things happen for Australia. Those are the kinds of attacks that you really want to be able to bank on, particularly when your top order isn't making runs and firing on a consistent basis.
Yeah, I think Cameron Green, unfortunately, probably isn't going to have enough of a sample size bowling with these four guys, because, you know, you'd suggest that Lyon, although he may go on for, you know, for several more years. And then it becomes a slightly different conversation in that, you know, that great Australian attack that we talk about was a four-man attack. It was really balanced by the fact that Shane Warne was able to bowl hard overs on the first day of a test match. I know everyone always talks about Gilchrist being the fulcrum of that side. I actually think it was Warne, because he could do the job that a third or fourth seamer would do on day one and bowl, you know, two for 50 off 15 or 16 overs.
Absolutely.
Um, But yeah, I think it is the fact that those guys are so close together. I think if I look at what might strike more fear into me, it would definitely be where you've got two great bowlers backed up with, you know, two very, you know, very good bowlers.
One of them can bowl 150 Ks an hour.
Correct. And now I think you've got, you know, four guys who are very, very good. So I suppose it's, you know, do you want two greats and two very goods, or do you want four very, very goods? Is the conversation. Whilst we're on bowling attacks, can we talk about the New Zealand bowling attack in this test match? Scott Kugelein came in. There was talk, obviously, leading into the game. You know, is this an opportunity that we get Mitchell Santner in? And I think we've talked off air, and Glenn Phillips did a great job. But yeah, Kugelein only bowling nine overs in the game. Let's kind of forget the runs he scored, because Santner, you know, it's got that ability in the locker as well. Did New Zealand go in with the right balance? You know, what could they have maybe done differently?
I think the question is more around, we talked a little bit about the role. There just didn't appear to be a role for our fourth seamer. And I think, you know, when you compare it to the Australian side, as we said, there's just no way out for you as a batter when Australia is bowling, that you have to earn every single run, and they just at both ends, at all times, you're going to have to work really, really hard. And what we saw in this series particularly is that Matt Henry was just far and away our best bowler. And then it was, you know, we were jokingly sort of saying, you know, it was sort of like the Richard Hadley days where, you know, people were saying it's Richard Hadley at one end and it's Ilford Thirds at the other end. I think that's, you know, a bit demeaning to someone like Ben Sears
Ben Sears had a terrific test match in this test match. Can we just talk about him for 60 seconds ago?
Go back to
your point, because every time he came on to bowl, he made something happen in every one of his spells, even if it wasn't taking a wicket, and he took some terrific wickets in this series, in the second test. It was one of those things where you felt like he was going to do something every time he came on, and he's on debut, right? It's his first test match in his New Zealand jersey, and I thought he was outstanding. And he bowled himself on the last day into the ground.
Well, and even at the point where we were saying, you know, he's probably bowled too many. He had an energy gel, I think, and his speeds were down maybe 4 or 5 Ks, but then they kind of came back up to that 140-odd. Okay, the game was almost done at that point, but got to be really impressed with the engine that he showed. It looks like he's got a bit of mongrel in him as well.
It's exciting when he celebrates. You know,
when you celebrate that caught and bowled after having that catch dropped, it was almost like, it was a fantastic attitude to see from him.
It's really exciting. I mean, we often from New Zealand, we don't get the speedsters, and Sears is someone that has that extra bit of pace. It's anything over 140, right, is starting to trouble really quality batsmen. And we saw that with the way he got Green out. You know, Green's defending and it hits the bat and rolls, you know, goes backwards onto the stumps. And those kind of actions are really what gets you excited as a New Zealand fan.
And did a bit with it as well, which someone like Lockie doesn't do it, you know, a massive amount with it compared to what
we saw. Yeah, maybe not off the decks. Yeah. Lockie can often get
a little bit of swing.
The new ball to swing. I think it's going to be a matter of, for New Zealand, to try to keep these guys fit, because we've seen O'Rourke showed a lot of promise in his couple of tests so far, but obviously has got a hamstring injury. Sears has had a lot of injuries throughout his career. You know, we talked a bit about his action. You know, it's not the most durable action in terms of being a quick bowler and running in and hitting that sort of pace. But look, that's the challenge now for New Zealand. I'm sure I even think back to some of the conversations we had around in January, you know, when we were looking forward to the year of cricket ahead, and there was a lot of conversations about what are New Zealand going to do? How are they going to kind of transition from Southey, Bolt, Wagner into this next kind of era? And I think the trouble that they've had is that there's been no one in the kind of 26 to 30-year-old age that they've really felt like, apart from Jameson, who obviously has got his own injury problems, is kind of the next cab off the rank. And, you know, they've tried Kugelein. We've seen Duffy in white ball stuff. We've seen Blair Ticknor get opportunities. And I don't think any of them have really done quite enough, or that the selectors have really shown enough confidence in them. Captains have shown enough confidence in them to go, you are now the answer. Mm. Instead, it's been Matt Henry who, you know, someone can give me his stats for the series, but, you know, he has really shown. And I think Tim Southey said at the end of the game in the press conference, He was talking about how pleased he was to see Matt Henry, someone who has been on the edge of this New Zealand side for a long time and had to wait really, really long time and kind of bide his time for these opportunities while we had the Southie, Bolt, Wagner, you know, Jameson kind of combination. And he's really getting consistent game time now and showing what a quality bowler he is.
Yeah, Matt Henry, 17 wickets at just under 16. So, yeah, a really good series.
And a strike rate of, what's his strike rate? 29. Yeah. And he bowled 84 overs in the series. And the next best is Southie, or the next most is Southie with 70 overs. So he got through a huge workload. And really, he felt like the guy who carried New Zealand's attack through this whole series.
And that's to pick up back on your point, I think that's the thing that, you know, you compare it with the Aussie attack. They were able to use their bowlers however they wanted. They could bowl them in 4-over spells, 5-over spells, 3-over spells. New Zealand wasn't afforded that luxury because they didn't have the 4 or 5 bowlers that they could build pressure with. They had two, you know, probably two at a time that they could build some pressure with. And it meant that Matt Henry had to bowl long spells. It meant Ben Sears probably went an over or two too long in different spells. And, I think about pivotal moments in the game, and this might transition back to Australia, when Matt Henry is, you know, gets Alex Carey, gets the dismissal given LBW, DRS overturned. You know, I feel like at that time it looked kind of like Carey thought, maybe I'm out here, you know, and he goes.
It looked like a review to have a half a hope that it was going to be missing the wickets.
Yeah, because that was a big partnership. Yeah. And Carey goes, you know, goes for the review. It is missing leg. And, you know, from that point on, Alex Carey, I think, took control of that game. And like you said, you must be so delighted, I think, in terms of some of the questions being asked around this Australia side. I mean, they haven't all been answered in this series, but I think for Carey, this must be a huge boost to his confidence. And it's a matter of those questions now going away for a little while.
Oh, absolutely. And most of those questions were being asked by me, and particularly after the first innings. I mean, you have a look at the three dismissals in the first three innings that Alex Carey had in this test series. They weren't dismissals where you were able to put aside those question marks that some people were asking of him. He dropped a catch in this test match that probably should have been taken. So he wasn't having a great game up until walking out to bat at 4 for 79 or 5 for 80 as it was when he walked out this morning, and there were still 199 runs to get. For him to get 98 not and steer Australia home, that is the stuff that not just answers questions, but that's the kind of innings and the kind of test match victory that can define a whole career for your country potentially. And so I think he has answered those questions for as long as, I mean, Australia have got a long gap before we play red ball cricket again, but he has answered those questions for sure. And he has shown his critics, me included, that he is capable of delivering match winning performances for Australia. And all, by the way, he got 10 dismissals in this test match.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I was really, really pleased for him, a member of the union, obviously. Disappointed he didn't get over the line for the 100. I thought personally there's a little bit of room for sentiment there from Australia, but Pat Cummins had other ideas and wanted to get off and get the team song done and get back to the hotel.
I have a few more New Zealand thoughts, but before, like, while we're sort of on the questions for Australia, you've mentioned it a few times to me, sort of off air, Baldy, the Steve Smith situation. That's probably a question that is still hanging over this Australia side. I know we talked about in the last test that one of the questions was, okay, Steve Smith's gone up. Is Cameron Green ready to bat 4? I think he looks like, yes, he is.
Absolutely.
And the way he's able to contribute to
the side. He's more ready to bat 4 than Steve Smith is to open.
Yes.
I completely agree. And the reason that I think that is the case is because Cameron Green in this test series showed tremendous poise in situations where he was under pressure and his team needed him to put out a Herculean effort. He had the most runs in this series, I think 238, had 174 not out, but still you've got to get those runs. And he batted tremendously.
Well, that was a match-winning performance.
Yep, and batted tremendously with Josh Hazlewood to take that game away from New Zealand. The challenge that Steve Smith is going to face going forward is that now question marks are starting to be asked about how confident he is knowing where the top of his off stump is. And throughout his career, when he's been making 100 after 100 and run after run after run, series after series, it's always been said that Steve Smith knows exactly where his front, where his off stump is. And if you bowl straight to Steve Smith, he'll pick you off all day between mid-on and mid-wicket. And that's not the case in the last 12 months of him, or 6 months of him opening the batting. He had his front pad or his back pad ripped off twice in this series.
Yeah, Binksy, you said it was so rare to see him get hit when in that, you know, in the second innings where he gets hit on the pad and he's immediately reviewed it, but you know, he's getting hit in front of the middle stump, but it's the case that he doesn't normally miss those.
Yeah, look, it's been a strength, hasn't it? And I think a lot of teams have probably got carried away thinking, you know, those big new balance pads look like a huge target, but he doesn't miss and he tucks the ball so well. But, you know, I think probably hasn't helped by his comments saying, you know, I average 80 as an opener. He's now had, I think, you know, eight knocks, I think, as an opener, two not outs. His average is probably, I've just done the math very quickly, about 170 runs divided by those six outs. So, he's probably not going to sort of unearth that particular tweet or Instagram post again.
The problem is he looks indecisive around his off stump. Yeah. You know, it's sometimes Shane Watson's a big candidate. So it gets hit in the front pad, but he got a good stride forward and occasionally missed one. Steve Smith looks indecisive at the moment on and around off stump. And traditionally he's been great at that. And openers need to be decisive around their off stump. They need to leave well. Khawaja leaves very well. Manus, when he's batting well, leaves very well. So that is...
Please try again.
Something went wrong. Please try again. There we go. That's probably says it all, doesn't it?
It does.
That's Steve. Steve Smith talking right there.
Hey, Smithy.
Should we move on?
Yes, are we staying with New Zealand for a second? You got a couple of points written down, I think, Lip.
I guess that probably I think that New Zealand. I don't know. We it's a really deflating loss for New Zealand, and for me as a fan, because this was the opportunity that we had. On the other sense, you know. I made a deal with Baldy at the end of day one to say, can you just give us a lead of 270 and I'll come away from this test and, you know, you can win, but I'll come away from this test happy. And I'm certainly happy with the way that they bounced back, because it was really interesting. After day one at the press conference, New Zealand gets bowled out. Matt Henry takes a couple of wickets. He's the one at the press conference. And the guys were talking to him, questions are being asked to him about our batting lineup and the performance of that side, that part of our team. And Matt Henry kind of said, it's okay for the other team to bowl well. Like, I have confidence in this batting group that they will come good. And then, you know, then day two, day three, they actually did that. They went and put a big score. They put Australia under a lot of pressure. But I think if they're being, you know, the ruthless mindset that they want to look to use, they'll look back at moments in this game and think, we really didn't ever put Australia out of sight. And, you know, you think of Tom Latham, Kane Williamson, Daryl Mitchell, Ratchan Ravindra, all get 50s, but none of them went on and got that 100 that you needed. Then even in the final, you know, the third day, the way that tail just kind of crumbled after tea. And it wasn't even about necessarily the fact that they fell for only 30 runs or whatever it was for the final four wickets. It's the way that they fell quickly. And I think what that meant is that there was extra time in all of those sessions that meant that they didn't have a brand new ball, you know, a 10-over-old ball to bowl with this morning on day four. And it meant that, you know, when in all of the sessions, the tea session on day three and the first session on day four, there was half an hour at the end of each of those sessions where Australia was able to get away from them. So I think the kind of game management, time management in the situation is something they'll look back on and think we could have done that a lot better.
Yeah, even when you're just looking at the stats, Lippy, and I think the thing that's, you know, stands out to me when you kind of look at the series averages is, unfortunately, for me, the most important column is the number of matches, and it's only two, and we've not really got going, and we've got so many talking points. But when you kind of look at it, 650s across the two test matches for New Zealand, just 350s for the Australians, but they've got a big 100 from Cameron Green. And in fairness, one of those 50s is Alex Carey's 98 not out.
And so, Manus got 90 in the first inning.
So those are the differences, I think, that you've got those kind of almost three, you know, 300s. And as you say, that changes the complexion of probably the game, the way you're setting up a chase, the game management piece. But look, a cracking test match, this one, I think. at Hagley Oval. Unless there's any final bragging rights, Bawley, it might be time to move on. Let's talk a little bit of India, England. We wrapped up the Test match, which finished in 3 days, obviously, in Dharamshala, a resounding series victory for India. But we got heaps and heaps of comments, and we said we'd talk a little bit more about this in the context of the series rather than just that game. Lippy, I might hand over to you to kind of run this segment, because I know there's probably some questions around around England and the way that they go forward, but also some plaudits that we want to give to India, and probably a couple of questions around India as well in terms of they've got a couple of decent players that they're going to need to get back into this side. Clearly, they're not going to necessarily play three men spin attacks on the road. So, what does that look like for their permutations? And we also want to talk a little bit of captaincy as well, because I thought Rohit was brilliant throughout the course of this series.
Yeah, I might just pick up on that, because I think the captaincy stuff is so interesting with the way that, in the context of the way that England has decided to play their cricket, because what it's meant is that every side that's played them has had to come up with a way to combat that. And it's something that they haven't necessarily had to combat before. So each captain, I think back to the way Babar Azam handled it, the way that
Pat Cummins played rope-a-dope for two tests in an effort to kind of, absorb all of that pressure and then be able to give it back someday. Rohit adopted a different approach, didn't he?
Well, I think that, India just backed their own style of cricket to really combat England's. They went, okay, well, actually I would say that probably that first test, there were things that Rohit probably went, okay, we haven't done especially well here. We've made a few decisions. We've kind of got into our shell a little bit. I think when they were, they're batting, they felt a bit of that pressure. I think, certainly when they were chasing that score, and they let Ollie Pope kind of get away. Their bowlers were able to, he was able to get on top of their bowlers. But I think that he deserves a huge amount of credit. Firstly, for not really getting upset by the way that they lost that first test, because I think that there would have been so much pressure on him and that squad after their first loss. They're obviously going into a situation where they're expected to win every game at home. I mean, every game, but, every game at home in particular. And it could have really put a dent in the confidence of that side. It really could have, sort of taken them apart a little bit. But I think that the way he kind of held them together, and I think probably the whole group deserve a lot of credit for the way a lot of those young guys came in and actually were able to express themselves, the likes of Jarrell, the likes of Sarfraz Khan, throughout that series. Yeah, I really think that they've done a brilliant job to hold all this together, and actually probably by the end of the series, they were the ones who were actually putting their foot down and being more confident. They appeared more confident in their approach.
I agree. England, a lot has been spoken about England's atmosphere and the environment that England create under Baswell, which is one of belief and confidence and come in and express yourself when there's few repercussions for playing your natural game. The credit and the plaudits that Rohit and his team and his support staff should get and the coaches should get is all of the young guys that came in throughout this series, whether it was Akash Deep as a bowler, whether it was Devdutt Padukal, Sarfraz Khan, etc., they all managed to express themselves and give a great account of themselves and succeed in that environment. So regardless of the tactics and the on-field stuff that Rohit did very, very well as well, managing his bowlers, what have you, he created a great environment for that next man up mentality, which meant that they got contributions from all of those guys through the course of the series.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to go too much into probably the detail of this, because I think I've said this a number of times now. India deserved to win. There's a lot of rhetoric around, in England were in these games. The reality is, I think the scoreline of 4-1 is a fair reflection of the series.
Yep, so do I. Mm-hmm.
England deserved to win the test match that they won. When a guy gets 200, you can't really you can't turn around and say, well, they didn't deserve to have taken some plaudits from a game. But on Bawley's point, absolutely, this talk around allowing people to express themselves and play their natural game. We forget, obviously, Jaiswal's only played 9 test matches. He looks like he's been at the top of the order for 10 years. But I think that difference is that Jaiswal and Sharma and Shubman Gill, who again, you know, has been in and around the side for a little while now, they scored, you know, 600s between them, which allowed Padacal and it allowed Sarfraz, it allowed Dhruv Jurel to come in and actually express themselves. And, you know, they have scored, I can't even do the math, but probably half of the 15 or 1650s that India have been able to sort of chalk up and really turn the screw from a batting perspective on England. And then, you know, clearly there's a golfing class between the spin attacks, which is you know, really kind of unraveled for England in the final three test matches. We've seen obviously Ashwin and Kuldeep really go to town on this England lineup throughout the course of the test series.
And I think that could, you know, the way that Rohit managed the spin attack and particularly Kuldeep, because I think it was the third test, perhaps when Duckett was really getting stuck into him. Maybe was it maybe the end of one day, and then he came back on the next morning, and it could have been a scenario where you go, okay, well, Duckett's got into him. You know, I'm not going to bowl him again now until Duckett gets out. Rohit gave him the confidence and said, look, I'm going to bowl you now. And he bowled a brilliant, you know, five or six over spell, ended up getting Duckett with, you know, the worst ball that he bowled in that spell.
Yeah.
But then basically from that moment on, Kuldeep was, I think, you know, the best bowler in the series from that point on. Bumrah had been, I think, the best bowler up until that point. But yeah, you know, I think that as a spinner, you know, as someone who was a spinner, having the confidence of your captain, just it really transforms the way you're able to bowl.
Absolutely. You don't fear running into bowl thinking, if I bowl a bad ball now, I'm going to get hooked. Yeah. You can run in and go, I'm going to bowl six of these balls, and I'm going to bowl this, and then I'm going to bowl this, and then I'm going to bowl this, and then this is going to happen, then this is going to happen, then I'm going to bowl the wrong, and it's going to come back into Ben Stokes. I'm going to pin him on the back pad, and he's going to be out LBW. And those were the plans that Kuldeep as a wrist spinner was able to develop, because he had the confidence in his own skill set and he had the confidence of the captain to set the right field and to bowl to a plan and know that he's not going to get hooked if he has a bad over. So, yeah, it was really, really good captaincy from Rohit to back his wrist spinner in that situation, because it would have been easy to go back to a guy who's got 500 wickets, a guy who's, you know, averaged 20 or less in the last 24 months in Ravindra Jadeja.
What do you make then, Binksy, of all of the leadership comments that have come out following this series on an England point of view? Because, you know, I guess it's been pointed out England won 10 of their first 11 tests, and now that record, I think, is 14 and 23, which makes it, my math, so they've won 4 of their last 12 tests, which suddenly doesn't look like their record is very impressive. I have seen some, what I think, kind of ridiculous comments like, you know, McCullum out, all of that sort of stuff. But I think probably more on a balanced level, I have seen some comments sort of saying that they definitely need to think about their approach a bit more than that maybe they have in these five tests. And that now it's really, really crucial that they go home in this English summer and pretty much beat the West Indies and Sri Lanka, who come there 6-0, to kind of justify the way that they're playing their cricket. How do you, I mean, is that those comments fair?
Well, I think ultimately the comments around changing the management are absolute rubbish. We've gone to India where no team has won for the last 12 or 13 years, and surprise, surprise, we haven't won the series. So, I think. Then there's the manner in which you've lost this series. And I don't even buy into that to a certain extent, because we did have opportunities throughout the course of the series and we weren't good enough to take those opportunities. And I think we've already talked about some of the reasons for that. We haven't scored enough hundreds. Our established players in Bairstow and Root haven't, other than a brilliant 100 from Joe Root in the last test match, the fourth test match, haven't really, you know, shown the way. And then we've seen, you know, some performances, some consistency from Zach Crawley at the top of the order without going past 70-odd as his top score. You know, a pretty decent 100 in that test match from Ben Duckett. But we haven't seen that sort of consistency in those performances. Yeah. And again, I think some comments around, you know, the perceived arrogance or cockiness of the team, they've made some comments that probably they'd like to, you know, they would like to roll back. But absolutely, going into a home summer against, you know, let's be honest, a West Indies side that has just put up a great performance in winning a test match in Australia.
Yeah, they play well.
So, you know, they're not going to be underestimated, I think, coming over to the UK. And then a Sri Lanka side that, you know, really is in a bit of, you know, a bit of turmoil. You know, there's a lot going on both on and off the field for that Sri Lankan side.
And traditionally not the greatest of travellers, you know, England, Australia, New Zealand kind of areas.
Absolutely. So I think England should be targeting throughout the course of this summer that, you know, they're putting a similar result on those two teams that they've just had put on them in a 5-test series in India. So I think they want to be walking away, absolutely. With a goal of, you know, probably, you set your goal a little bit like Glenn McGrath, 5-0. Mm-hmm. You know, which test match do you want us to lose? But I think, you know, realistically, if you gave them 5-1 across those two series now, I think that's roughly where we would want the, want the series to be if weather doesn't intervene. But then, I think we've then got some question marks around, some of the personnel. Bordy was saying this morning, Dan Lawrence has mixed a lot of Gatorade. You know, he's been on a lot of tours now, probably back to that series in the West Indies. Johnny Bairstow's played his 100th game. Actually, he was pretty consistent through this series in terms of getting 25 or 30, but not converting one of those scores. And then, clearly some questions around Ollie Pope and probably the other Ollie Robinson. In terms of, you know, whether or not from a cultural perspective he's bought in enough to the side. And realistically, I think as long as Jimmy Anderson carries on, you know, he's probably going to play 4 of those 6 test matches if he can stay on the park. And you've got the likes of a Chris Wokes, who's got a fantastic home record. He's well thought of by the management in terms of his ethics. So you've got a guy that can come in and do that, you know, Robinson-like job. And if Robinson isn't going to be bowling sort of mid-130s, Wokes will be. And then you've obviously had the emergence of a couple of options from a seeming perspective from England in home summers. Matthew Potts has come in and done pretty well and has had a really, really good Lions winter for England. So there's plenty of options there, but they're going to want a strong performance in this home summer for sure.
And I want to touch a little bit about which Indian players might kind of stick as well. But I guess while we're on the leadership, Stokes, a very quiet series for him in terms of the on-field performance. I mean, any sort of worries that, I don't know, anything from the captaincy side of things is starting to affect his performance? I don't know, any concerns around what his role is in the side if he's not going to bowl, although maybe now he is going to bowl in the home summer, do you think?
Bowled a good one in this test.
Yeah, look, bowled in this test match, I think, you know, as always said or has been saying, his target wasn't to bowl in this series, and if he did, it was a bonus. I think read between the lines, that means, you know, I'm intending that I want to be able to play a full role in the English summer. The reality is, particularly when we've got some of those conversations around whether Ben Folkes keeps his place, if Stokes isn't bowling, it makes it really, really difficult for them not to be able to do that. Yes, worries that, you know, he's averaged, I think, 20 in this series, top scorer 70. We expect more from him. We expect more from Bairstow. We expect more from Root. And now, you know, we're starting to expect that Crawley and Duckett have kind of, you know, if not cemented their places over the course of the McCullum-Stokes era. They've certainly started to turn around that tide of some of the criticism that they got early on, particularly for the way in which you might have seen them get out. So absolutely, we need Stokes to be coming to a situation where, you know, he's averaging 40 as a batter or 45 as a batter, particularly if he's only going to offer a little bit with a ball and bowl those hard spells or those impact spells where you really, really need something to happen.
And Baldy, we'll come to you now. I think this probably will be near the end of this episode. So let's finish with something fun in terms of the way we've talked a lot about some of these young English Indian players in particular and how they've come into the side and performed really well. It's absolutely impossible to kind of make selection decisions, you know, based on there's an IPL coming up and, you know, then a T20 World Cup and then there'll be, you know, all sorts of people will get injured and all everything will change to that point. But if you had to choose one of these young Indian players that have made their debut, so that doesn't count Jaiswal, it doesn't count Gill, who's obviously kind of more established, one of the younger players who have emerged in this series, when the likes of KL Rahul, the likes of Kohli, the likes of Shami are all back in the mix, maybe even a Rishabh Pant, which one do you think has the brightest chance to stay in the squad and kind of make a spot their own?
Stay in the squad is an interesting point that you make, because I immediately in my head thought Dhruv Jurel. And maybe he even stays in the squad as a specialist keeper and Rishabh Pant comes in as a specialist batter when he comes back and bats at five. But I really, really liked what we saw from Dhruv Jurel. He was very tidy as a wicket keeper. He performed well under pressure. It's not hard. You know, it's not that it's not hard, but it is harder to score runs under pressure than to score runs when things are all going very, very well for you. And he scored runs under pressure when India were in not in trouble, but needed to see the game home at 5 for 120. So he was a guy that immediately impressed me. I like Sarfraz. I think he's fun to watch. I think he's a great guy to have in the team, and I like him, but I've got no form or stats or analysis other than the eye test to back that up. I think he's a fun guy to watch.
You look at his first class stats and the
first class
helpful.
Record is very good, and he did perform well in this series. I think on the flip side, we know that it's probably not Pattidar now, I think, and that's probably the question that gets answered. It could be Padikkal. It probably is Sarfraz. It's definitely Jurel as the wicketkeeper, but I think, you know, we've probably learnt that it's maybe not Pattidar for now.
Yeah, Jurel definitely for me was super impressive, and I think he looks like he has the technique and the temperament to succeed outside of India as well, which mm-hmm. I think is going to be mm-hmm. an important important factor. And then Sarfraz as well. So I just wonder whether or not there potentially is a scenario, and we talk about the IPL and form in the IPL is important for Red Bull cricket now. And anyone who, you know, disagrees with that, go and look at some of the picks that have come out of that over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. If Dhruv Jurel has a good IPL, if Sarfraz has a good IPL, if Rahul can't get his injury sorted out, KL Rahul, Kohli clearly comes back into the India side. We've got Jaiswal, who's absolutely nailed on. Rohit's nailed on as captain. And Shubman Gill, I think, has nailed on his spot through the course of this. I think you could see, you know, a situation where a couple of those guys leapfrog. And because they've got Ravi Jadeja, and because they've got Ravi Ashwin, and because they've got Shami to come back and Bumrah, and, you know, they've got that ability to really pick a sensational attack, whether they go 2-2 or 3-1 or 3-2. They've got so many permutations there that I think they can actually probably get to a situation where they get both Sarfraz and Dhruv Jurel into the side, and Kohli as well. And who would want to play against that?
I know. And Baldy, I thought that we might have different views, because I thought you might just go with Sarfraz because of your love for him. But, I mean, Dhruv Jurel, again, was someone I was super impressed with. And I think, you know, I hope Rishabh Pant comes back, you know, fit and healthy. But he's been out of the game a long time. So I think there really is an opportunity for Dhruv Jurel to stick in the side for a while.
Absolutely. And if you think about what might be most successful for Rishabh Pant going forward, coming back from injury, is it might actually be more successful for him in the long term to not keep wicket for India and just bat as a batter and at number five and try and play an Adam Gilchrist-like role without having to have the added burden of being the wicket keeper as well and have Dhruv Jurel at seven. We haven't mentioned Hardik Pandya. We haven't mentioned Akash Deep, who had a really good series.
I was going to say Akash Deep, because I think what he, you know, yes, it's only one test and, you know, really only one innings that he made a significant contribution, but from what I saw from him, it wouldn't surprise me if he, I mean, certainly I think he should jump Mukesh in terms of, what he offered in this series and what he's offered so far. It wouldn't surprise me if he jumped Prasidhi Krishna, you know, and became kind of the fourth option and is in that squad when it's Shami. I mean, you know, good luck getting past Shami, Siraj and Bumrah, you know.
But absolutely. In England, he could be the fourth seamer. I mean, there would have to be a conversation about the batting order, but you know, he could be the fourth seamer for India from a bowling perspective.
Yeah, fun stuff.
Absolutely. Is that time to leave the podcast?
Probably it is.
Right. Well, we're going to go off into Christchurch and celebrate Michael's victory. And
my team's victory.
Well done, Baldy. Well done.
And commiserate with Stu.
Can I just say, I want to give us one little bit of credit here. Our predictions for both of these two series, we predicted 4-1 India and we predicted 2-0 Australia. So we do you know, we make a lot of, we do say a lot of things that don't come true, but we did say both of those two things. So I think we can celebrate the fact that we know a tiny little bit.
When you say we, was that you or was that the collective?
I think the collective. Right. I think there might have been, me and Baldy both did go to 2-0 Australia. Yeah. And I think there were some mixed views about 4-1 to India. There was maybe a 3-2 in there.
That might have been me
as
actually.
Well. Yeah. But
I know I was a 4-1.
Yeah, I think the majority had 4-1. So I think we will celebrate the fact that we maybe know a little bit about cricket.
Well, okay, if we're going to take that.
Or we just got lucky.
Well, pop a comment in the comments below and let us know whether you think it was luck or judgment. But look, been a pleasure to be down at the Hagley Oval. In some ways, a shame we didn't see 5 days of Test cricket. But
such a great place, wasn't it?
But we certainly saw 4 days of action packed in to the Hagley Oval. But for now, it is good night and God bless from us here in Christchurch. We'll be back on the Top Order podcast in your feeds with our IPL preview shows. We'll be switching from the whites to the pajamas, the red to the white ball, and covering our IPL preview, where we will talk about every single team in this year's tournament, which is coming up pretty damn soon. Good night.
Podcast Network.